Session number 32711, Reel 1.
The air crew pool used to be for the Air Corps, and I told him that I was on orders to go to Wendover, Utah. I says, but the difference was normally they would have a shipping order of 30 or 35 people with bombardiers, navigators, gunners, the whole bit. But because there are only 10 or 11 of us on this one, I was kind of caught by surprise, and I wanted to find out why. Well, he told me that I was probably going to go over and take over a crew of a B-24 pilot who got sick or got hurt. And so I accepted it. We got on the train, and we got off the next day at Wendover, Utah. And the first thing I could see was this big high-tail 29, that tails on 29. And I said to my two friends, I says, we don't belong here because those aren't 24s, they're 29s. So Tibbetts met us at the station, took us immediately out of the field into a room and explained to us what we were doing there, that we had a bomb that can destroy an entire city, and we would start training and getting checked out in the B-29s so we can get ready to go overseas. We went overseas in June of 1945, and it just was mind-boggling to think that one bomb in one airplane could destroy an entire city. I had never heard of atomic power. And I'm sure a lot of the other people didn't in the squadron, too. But he told us that we start training and we'd be on our way overseas as soon as the scientists had everything under control. They had problems with the fat man triggering. They had problems with it. It was a touchy situation. The Hiroshima bomb was, the chain reaction was started by firing a projectile into the mass of the uranium, and that started the chain reaction. In ours, everything happened with inside. It was the implosion. And they had all kinds of mirrors and things in there that I know anything about, but it was the more tricky of the two bombs, and they weren't sure that they had all the things taken care of. But we sure as hell hope they did when we took off.
Glad you got off.
We were lucky. I'm glad we were lucky. Yes?
How much clearance did that bomb have when it was let go through the bomb bay?
Not very much. That would have been a hell of a time for the engineers to find out it didn't fit in the bomb bay.
Did you ever revisit any of the sites?
No, I had no desire to go over there. What are you going to look at people? You killed a lot of people. What are you going to say to them?
What did you say?
That's right. I mean, that goes without saying. Not only our boys, but the Japanese people, too. But I didn't want to go. Tibbetts went over there along with Sweeney, my pilot. And I didn't care to go. I wasn't invited. Hell, I was only a second lieutenant, so I had no choice.
Fred, I was there in 1950. I got a lot of pictures on it.
Yeah. Yes?
How long did the scientists approximately work on the atomic bomb?
Oh, they were working for quite some time.
Like,
the entire project cost $2 billion. So we had the two bombs, one that dropped on Hiroshima and one on Nagasaki. Now, as I go into the mission, we'll find out we had problems with our mission. But one of the things that we used to do when we flew other missions was if we couldn't bomb our target, we'd just jettison into the ocean. Well, we couldn't do that with this thing because it was a $2 billion proposition, and if we would have done that, we probably would have ended up in jail, court-martialed, or whatever. But luckily, we didn't have to do that.
Is it true that when you got back and you landed the airplane, you ran out of gas?
Yeah, well, I'll get into that.
Right. How was your crew selected?
That was done by Tibbetts.
More than just two airplanes.
Yeah, that was done by Tibbetts. He had the project was called Silver Plate, and whenever he mentioned that word anywhere, generals, he was a full colonel, but when he mentioned that anywhere, he got what he wanted without any questions asked. He got six C-54s that we had. We had the 320th troop carrier, and they were our own airline between Tinian and the U.S., and anytime we wanted anything, they would just send the aircraft back to the U.S. or wherever to pick up the stuff that they needed to make sure that the bombs were going to be working right.
Yeah, Fred, you mentioned the cost of the second one. Was it $2 million, you said, or $2 billion?
$2 billion, the whole project.
Oh.
Thank
$1,745. That's right. So you can mend with the days. Yes.
Yeah, Fred, I saw a picture of a 509 to 829 with pumpkins painted on the side. What was that?
That's what we use for the amount of missions we flew. On the nose of the boxcar, you'll find four pumpkins, and a red one. That was the Nagasaki mission. So that was how we designated our missions. Over in Europe, they used the drawing of a bomb. But we used these pet pumpkins for our designation as to how many missions we flew against the Japanese Empire.
Just one more question. From what one reads and everything, is it correct to surmise that you actually armed them in flight? You didn't?
Yes.
In other words, everything was rearmed up when you were in the air and everything on your way.
We armed them before we went to 30,000 feet. We had a weaponeer on board. He was a Lieutenant Commander Ashworth. This was a Navy and Army and Air Force combined operation.
Was anybody burnt doing that there with that radioactivity and everything in there?
No. I know you're referring to something else that happened when it was on the ground, I think, when you were trying to put this thing together. Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah, I read about it somewhere. Somebody got burned and died.
No, I don't know anything about that. The scientists were at Los Alamos, and we were at Wendover. But our only operation with the scientists would be through Colonel Tibbetts. Scientists never talked to us directly. They briefed us about the bomb, and they told us what to expect as far as the bomb was concerned and what was going to happen, but that's as far as it went. Yes?
There's a series on Colonel Tibbetts in the Tribune.
Yes.
And the other day he mentioned that their doctor gave them some cyanide tablets. Did they do that for you?
Yeah, they did that.
Did they discuss it with the crew?
Pardon?
Say that they really discussed
it? No, they didn't discuss it with us. Colonel Tibbetts had it with him, and if we would have gotten in trouble and we got shot down over Japan, he'd give you the cyanide pill and say, well, it's your choice. Either that or you're going to be tortured by the Japanese, and I'm sure they would have kept us alive as long as they could and just gave us fits because of what we did. But luckily we didn't have to do that.
How did you come to name the plane Boxcar?
The first pilot or the aircraft commander was named Bock, B-O-C-K. And when you get together with your crew before you put a name on the aircraft, everybody submits names, and one of them named Boxcar was a flying boxcar with wings, and that was accepted by the crew, so it was Boxcar, B-O-C-K-S-C-A-R. Mm-hmm.
So you'd actually thrown three more missions over Japan, dropping conventional bombs before you dropped them?
Four. Mm-hmm. I flew four. We flew missions before we dropped the atomic bomb, so we'd get used to of our bombing from 30,000 feet. We operated with no fighter escort. We operated one airplane against one city, and again, we were at 30,000 feet, and the Japanese aircraft had a hard time getting up there. They weren't good as the German aircraft, but they were coming up to meet us when we were over Nagasaki, but I guess when they saw the explosion, that was the end of that.
Fred, I got a question. Back when they did the magazine section in the Tribune a couple of years back, they did your diary. Was that your own personal diary? Or was that
that's what I wrote after the mission, not during. Because I took the navigator's log and I tied in the times for everything that was done because he had to do that. So I tried to remember the thoughts that I had at the time. And yet the thoughts I had, I remember just prior to dropping the bomb, I thought we were going to kill a lot of people, a lot of women and children and elderly people, but that was the nature of the beast. There was nothing we could do about that. Yes.
What happened to the plane?
What plane?
What happened to the plane after, the boxcar?
Well, we came back safe. Boxcar is at the Air Force Museum in Dayton. It's been on display there since 1962, and you can get to see it.
How old were you?
23.
Are both those planes intact? I just wanted to find out real quick. Are both those planes intact that are on display?
No, the Enola Gay was part of the Smithsonian display, and just the fuselage was on display. But they're going to put the Enola Gay back together again, and they're going to put it at Dulles Air Force, at Dulles Field, or in New York.
No, the same thing with the boxcar?
No, the boxcar is at the Air Force Museum at Dayton, Ohio already.
But that's intact, though.
It was flown in there. In fact, I've got the last flight plan that was taken. In fact, I got into the aircraft and I stole it. I also stole a flare pistol that I shot to let people on Okinawa know we were in trouble and we wanted to get on the ground as quickly as possible. So
what
I stole those two
codes,
things.
Fred?
Pardon?
What were your color codes? Did you have on the flare color codes?
No, I just fired everything.
The first one was
red, which meant there were wounded on board. After that, as they came off the rack, I just fired them. I fired about eight or nine of them.
They just know that you were in trouble. That's
well, the red one, yeah. You could see the rescue equipment going out to the end of the runway. The fire engines, the ambulances, and everything else.
I remember the Enola Gay sitting up here at O'Hara for several years.
Yes.
So was your airplane there too?
No.
Just the Enola Gay?
Just the Enola Gay. Tibbetts flew into there and it stayed in the hangar there.
Oh, yeah. I was a kid when I started flying on it.
And then finally they decided to give it to the Smithsonian.
It's kind of a shame. I mean, it just sat there.
Tibbetts was very unhappy what they did to it for the display of the Enola Gay. They took the wings and the engines off and they just showed the fuselage.
Did you hit the spot that you wanted?
No, we were about. You mean our
they said in the articles that the mountain range absorbed a lot of the shock.
Well, that's why there wasn't that much damage, that's why there wasn't that many killed, much more killed, because our bomb was four times stronger.
Where it supposed to be?
Yeah, no, not the actual. It was supposed to be over the center of the city, but when the bombardier. So I'll get into that.
Okay.
Yeah, Fred, after you dropped the bomb, how long was it in a duration of time that you received the first shockwave?
Well, the bomb took 50 seconds to explode. And we got back, we got there were three reports, three shockwaves that hit the aircraft. The first one was the worst, and that shook the aircraft up pretty thoroughly, and all we could do was just look at each other and hope that there wasn't going to be any damage to the aircraft, so we'd have to have a forced landing and get in all kinds of problems. And then a short time after that one came, we got a second one of lesser intensity, and then we got a third one of lesser intensity than the second one. So the bomb took about 50 seconds to explode, and I'd say about maybe 30 seconds after that we got the shock blast. And the same thing happened to Colonel Tibbetts in his Enola Gay. But I don't think they were as strong as ours.
What was your speed as you were going away?
190 indicated.
Were you making a diving turning?
The minute we released the bomb, and I'll get into that too. The minute we released the bomb, we had to make a 60-degree bank and go 150 degrees in the opposite direction. Because if we had gone a straight line, the bomb falling on a trajectory, we would have been over the point of blasting, and of course the scientists didn't want to take that chance in causing damage to the aircraft, so they devised the maneuver to go 150 degrees in the opposite direction. Let me get into the mission real quick, and then if you have more questions, I'll be glad to answer them. We took off from Tinian on August 9th at 3:47 in the morning, and we headed for our rendezvous point at Yakushima, which is at the southern end of the Japanese Empire. It took us 6 hours to get there. We were a strike force of three aircraft. The boxcar carried the atomic bomb. The Great Artiste, which was our crew aircraft, carried the instrumentation that was supposed to be dropped at the same time we dropped the A-bomb. And then the other one was the photographic aircraft that was supposed to come along and record everything. Well, we got to our rendezvous point from 6 hours after takeoff first, and about 5 minutes later, we were joined by Captain Bach, who was flying our aircraft. We swapped aircraft for this mission because the Great Artiste had gone on the Hiroshima mission as the instrument carrying ship. And because we were going to lose the weather, Tibbetts decided that he had to change. And from that time on, there was a viable bomb. It could go any time, and we were hoping that the scientists were right, that they had gotten all the little quirks out of it, so nothing would happen to us. It didn't, so that was all right. But anyway, we went from there to our 30,000 bombing altitude and went on to our target of Kokura. Now, for some reason, we're only supposed to wait 15 minutes over the rendezvous point for the three aircraft to get together and go on to our primary target. Well, two of us were there, and the third aircraft, which was flown by Major Hopkins, who was a photographic aircraft, didn't show up, and we waited. And again, the briefing was for 15 minutes only and then go on to the primary target. For some reason, Sweeney decided to wait. We ended up waiting 45 minutes. We were at 30,000 feet, and we were burning all this gasoline, which was a waste. And I wondered, and I was only a second lieutenant, I wondered why we waited this long, because we were briefed 15 minutes, and then if the planes weren't there, the two main aircraft were there, the one that carried the atomic bomb and the instrumentation were assembled, and they just could have gone on, and the other photographic aircraft didn't make that much difference. You just could take pictures of the activities that went on that was in dropping the atomic bomb. So anyway, Sweeney was in charge of the whole thing, and we waited the 45 minutes. Finally, he decided, well, we better go on with it. And so we took off with just the two aircraft, with the great Artiste carrying the instrumentation and Boxcar carrying the Fat Man bomb. It took us about 45 minutes to get to Kokura, about 50 minutes to get to Kokura. Now, because of our delay over the rendezvous point, the weather had changed. When we got there, the cloud cover was about 7/10, 8/10, and we were told to drop the bomb visually only. So in hopes of dropping it visually, we made three bomb runs over Kokura in hopes that the bombardier BN up in the nose would be able to spot his aiming point. Well, we made the three runs, and we couldn't do it. So then we had to decide about going to our secondary target. But at this time, we had to check our gasoline supply, and when we checked it out with the engineer, the flight engineer, Kuharik, and Sweeney, and Almeri, and myself, we found out that we had enough gasoline to go to Nagasaki and then go into Okinawa as our emergency landing field because of the 45-minute delay. And also, and this I didn't know until we were up in the air when we were figuring the gasoline, again, I was only a second lieutenant. I wasn't let in on everything. When we were making the inspection of the aircraft on the ground before takeoff, it was discovered by Kuharik, our flight engineer, and Sweeney was with him, that the booster pump in the rear bomb bay, which carried 600 gallons, was non-functioning, wasn't working right. So that couldn't get that 600 gallons out of the rear bomb bay up to the wing tanks and into the engines. So, of course, Sweeney went to see Tibbetts and told him about it. And Tibbetts says, well, don't worry about it, because the 600 gallons you got in the rear bomb bay was ballast for the 10,000-pound bomb in the front bomb bay. Well, sure, he said that. We sure as hell needed the gasoline. But that's the way it went. So Sweeney accepted that, and he says, okay. So we took off under those conditions. Now we're getting to, we're over Kokura after the three bomb runs. We had to figure our gasoline supply. And again, we only had enough gasoline to make one bomb run to Nagasaki and go into Yantan on Okinawa. So we wasted no time, and we started out there. And, of course, when we get to Nagasaki, the cloud coverage was 9/10. And again, we had orders to drop this thing visually only. Now, this put us in a dilemma because we were ordered to drop the bomb visually only. So Sweeney and the weaponeer, Commander Ashworth, said that they had a conference, and they agreed that they were going to drop the bomb by radar, which was against orders. So it was agreed because we had no choice, and we wanted to deliver the bomb and get rid of it as quickly as we can and to make it a successful mission. So it was agreed that we'd make the bomb run on radar. Now, when you make a radar bomb run, the navigator's got a scope in the front part of the aircraft, and there's a radar operator in the back, and he's got a scope, and they combine and run to make sure that they're both coming up on the target. So when we got to Nagasaki, we were, it took about another hour, 45 minutes, somewhere there. And when we got there again, the cloud coverage was 9/10. We had to drop this thing visually. We couldn't. So we started our radar run. Now, again, the navigator and the radar operator in the back had control of the bomb run. We were about 95% completed on the radar bomb run. When up in the nose, Captain Deanne hollered, "I see it, I see it, I've got it." So, of course, when he said that, the bomb run was relinquished to him immediately, and the radar run was off. Now, what he saw, he felt that it was the place to drop the bomb. And as it turned out, it wasn't the center of the city. It was over the Urakami Valley, which was the industrial part where Mitsubishi had its big plant that still is there now. And they were, of course, making weapons for war in that area. So we dropped it over a good place. So when we dropped it again, we had to make our 60-degree bank to the left, go 150 degrees in the opposite direction so we'd be over the point of explosion. Now, when we made the turn, of course, we were all looking down, and of course, we couldn't see very much. We could see smoke and dust covering the entire city, and then little fires breaking out all over. And nobody was paying attention to what was happening to the mushroom cloud. And Ray Gallagher, who was from Chicago, and he was the assistant flight engineer, he hollered out, "The cloud is coming toward us." Now, the scientists had told us not to get anywhere near the cloud because it was radioactive, and it wouldn't have killed us immediately if we flew through it, but eventually we all would have been had radiation poisoning and died somewhere afterwards. So when we saw that, I think we ended up being about 100 yards away when we finally realized we were going to be in trouble. And Sweeney took the aircraft and dove it down to the right, full throttles, and for a while, when I looked out the window, I couldn't tell whether we were gaining on the mushroom cloud or was gaining on us. So I think that was the most perilous part of the mission right there. And nobody said a word, but we just looked. But we were lucky enough to pull away. And, of course, we went on to Okinawa. Now, Okinawa had been taken just previously by our forces, and they were still mopping up. And we tried to get landing instructions, and we made 4 calls for them to respond to us and give us the landing instructions. Well, there was no answer, so Sweeney said to me, he says, "Fire all the flares, I'm going in." He says, "The hell with them." So I fired all the flares. I fired as many as I could, the first one being the red, because I knew that would be the one that would get the most attention. So we fired them, and I think I fired about 7 or 8 afterwards. And then we were alongside the runway, and then we could see the fire equipment going out to the end of the runway. So Sweeney had to get into the approach, and he had to go a little bit further to the I forget what direction he got. But anyway, he had to break into the approach pattern, and in so doing, he cut out 2 or 3 aircraft. And we had no choice. We had to do it. So we got into the approach, and we were hot. We were doing about 150 miles an hour. And you're landing a B-29, you do it about 130. So when we hit the runway, we were doing 150. And when we hit the runway, we started to veer to the left. And a little further back from the active runway were aircraft from the field there on the Anton. And they were bombers and fighters and everything. I'm sure they were gassed and fully loaded. And if we would have gone into them, if we didn't have the fact the reversible props were used to bring the aircraft back under control and keep us on a straight line to go to our landing spot. But that was another ticklish part. And if it hadn't been for the reversible props, I wouldn't be here telling the story either. But we did continue on down the end of the runway, and we turned off. And just as we turned off the active runway, our number 2 engine quit. We were that low on gasoline. So we went to our hard stand, and we parked. We were the first B-29 that landed on Okinawa, and of course it caused quite a stir, and the GIs clustered around the aircraft. They started asking all kinds of questions about, you know, where are you from and what are you doing here? And of course, before we got out of the aircraft, Sweeney said, let's not say anything about what we did. Let's just tell them we're here for gas and we're going home. So, of course, they start asking the questions, what are we doing here? And we just answered we're here for gasoline and we had, had a bombing mission over Japan, but we didn't tell them what we did or what we carried. And then finally, when that was all done, we had to go get something to eat. We got in the truck and up to the mess hall, and by this time, the word had gotten around that the second bomb had been dropped on Japan, and everybody knew it. Everybody in the mess hall knew it. And we got in line to get the food, and there was a GI dishing out the food, and we got in front of him, and he said, do you gentlemen know that we just dropped another bomb on and he didn't use the word atomic. Atomic was still, it wasn't used at that time, it was too early. And we said, no, we didn't know anything about it. But he was just tickled pink. He says, well, I want you to know that the airplane came from this field. It was a P-38, and the bomb was the size of a golf ball. That's the kind of thinking that went on at that time. It was such a new thing. So anyway, we finished our meal, went back to the field, got into the aircraft, and flew back to Tinian. We got back about 10:30. By that time, there was no activity going on. But there was a photographer there, and he says, I got to line you fellas up. As soon as we got out of the aircraft, he grabbed us, and he says, I got to take a picture of you fellas. So he took the picture, and I've got, you're supposed to bring a table in here. I've got some pictures that you people can look at.
I'll see you bring a table in, Frank.
Yeah, so you can put those pictures out. Anyway, what was it?
You're just getting ready to have your picture taken, please.
Okay.
You're going to put on the table.
Yeah, and we right away got into the trucks to go back to be debriefed and ask questions by the intelligence. And after that, we just finished the interrogation. We went back home to our bunks and. That was the end of that. The whole mission took 17 hours from the time we took off, from the time we got back to Tinian. And we were happy to be home, and we were happy to be home safe after all the things that had happened to us. And the Hiroshima mission was perfect, no problems. But we were just wrought with all kinds of problems. And then we were lining up to take the picture. Somebody counted the number of people that were on board. We had 13. And nobody thought anything of it until that time, you know. So if you're superstitious, 13 is a good number or an unlucky number.
What happened to that photo chip was supposed to
be? I'm glad you asked, because that's how you can tell if people are listening. The photographic ship never showed up for us, with us, to go on to Kokura like they were supposed to. I talked to the navigator when we got back. What's his name? Steinke. And he was briefed at the same time we were. All the crews were briefed at the same time. And I said to him, I said, Steinke, where the hell were you? I said, we're waiting at 30,000 feet, and we're burning all that gasoline, and you guys don't show up. We were briefed for 15 minutes and to go on. I said, but we waited longer than that. He says, we were there. And I said, well, how can you say you were there when there were two aircraft ginning around waiting for you to get together so we can go on? He says, we were there. He says, maybe our altitude was a little higher. Well, he was up at 33,000 feet, he said. Well, that wasn't where they were briefed, and we never saw him. I never saw him. We were looking for him because we wanted to make sure that everybody was with us when we went on our bombing of the city. And then I says, well, how come you weren't at 30,000 like the rest of us? He says, he pointed to the pilot, he says, talk to him. Well, of course, hell, I couldn't ask the pilot because I was just a second lieutenant. It was none of my damn business. But he never joined up with us, and he nearly caused us to not finish the mission. That's why I say the name of the book is Decision in Nagasaki, the mission that almost failed. And it almost failed a couple of times. So that's the story of the second atomic bombing of Japan. And Enola Gay got all the publicity, as well as it should be. But whenever I talk to people, I say, well, okay, Enola Gay dropped the first atomic bomb, but we dropped the second one, and that was the one that ended the war.